Hey, Anne, how are you?
Hi, Preet.
I'm in San Francisco.
How's California?
California's fine. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
I had spotty internet service, spotty Wi-Fi on the plane, trying to catch up on all the news. But I'm glad you and I can get together and at least talk about some of the things that are happening today. Historic day in many ways. I think we're going down this road of impeachment, which seemed not likely just a week or two ago. And now, if you listen to the reports coming out of Washington, some people think it's all but inevitable. Lots of people's minds have been changed. So what happened today? The quote-unquote transcript of the call between the President of the United States from July 25th of this year and the President of Ukraine, President Zelensky, was released after all this sturm and drang about how it didn't need to be released and it was going to cause a lot of problems. Let's just start out with a couple of quick things, and I want to get your top-line takeaways about this call. It is not a transcript. Some things look like they may be the actual language used by the parties, the president's speaking, but it's not a transcript. It's notes. There's actually, if people haven't read it, there's a caution on the bottom of the first page that's saying it's not a verbatim transcript. The other reason why people think it's not a verbatim transcript is that there are ellipses. And it appears that the call was 30 minutes long, but the transcript is only about 5 pages single space. Now, I saw the president of Ukraine speak today, and he speaks in a sort of slow, slightly halting way because English is not his first language. So there seems to be a bunch missing. And apart from the fact that there's a lot of obsequiousness on the part of the Ukrainian president when he's talking to Donald Trump, what else did you think about this?
So I agree. I agree with all that to start with. And what I really felt was you and I talked a lot on Monday about how this is really about the president of the United States abusing his official office to try to get dirt on a political rival. And you know, we talked about the fact that Trump had already said publicly he'd made the call. He'd discussed Biden. We also saw all the reporting around the withholding of aid for Ukraine. And then to see this document, my first reaction was that it was actually worse even than I had expected it to be.
Much, much worse.
You had the same reaction.
Wasn't it much worse?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Didn't you assume, look, we've been talking to you and I, and then we've also been talking to other friends of ours who used to be in this business. Prosecution business, I mean, you assumed that the same administration that fights tooth and nail to not release, not release, not release, to the extent they decide they're going to release, it must have been, pretty good for them. I mean, I was expecting you and I were going to come in today and have a discussion about whether or not he's justified in saying, case closed.
Yeah.
Totally exonerated. And boy, it's a lot worse than people thought, given how quickly he relented in releasing it. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can think is that there's one of two possibilities. One is that he really miscalculated this as being not problematic in any way because there is no explicit quid. And if that's true, he really misunderstands the United States law, the United States Constitution, and he also misunderstands what an enormous abuse of power it is to use the Department of Justice in this way to try to push a Ukrainian president to abuse their law enforcement agencies. And so, that is one possibility. The other possibility, which may be less likely, but I think is worth considering, is that Pelosi moved pretty decisively. She moved pretty quickly as pieces of evidence started to come out to say, we're going to move forward with impeachment.
The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
I personally believe that Donald Trump does not want to be impeached. And so, she exerted power. It was likely that this was going to come out potentially anyway. And again, I think he didn't appreciate just how devastatingly problematic on its face this memo of this conversation is.
Yeah, it tells you something about their mindset. I mean, from the reporting we see, and again, you can't trust all the reporting, but given the speed with which they put it out and how much they usually don't want to put stuff out, it tells you something about what's in the minds of the president and his advisors about what they think of ethics, what they think of integrity, what they think of the scope of their power, what abuse of power means. This for him is just, this is what they do. Put aside the quid pro quo for a second, like completely. Just on its face, the call, the request, when you have two unequal parties, you have the president of a small country just elected, who, by the way, I mentioned the obsequiousness for a reason. Throughout, he makes it a point to tell Trump that he stayed in a Trump hotel.
Yeah.
He says, I should run for office more often because then I get to talk to you more often. It is not an equal relationship. And the president of the United States has a lot of authority, a lot of power. Forget whether or not he's withholding aid or not withholding aid. He tells him in the course of the conversation that there's stuff to look into with respect to Joe Biden. And I think Trump doesn't understand why that on its face alone is supremely problematic. Like, it kind of boggles my mind. It's not that different from what he did in the United States. I mean, he may not think it's bad when he's in America, calling up Jeff Sessions, if he has done this, and say, go after Hillary Clinton, or open up investigations of other adversaries of mine, or knock it off on Michael Flynn. As the Mueller report says, he did so with respect to Michael Flynn. He has learned no lesson from the Mueller investigation. He's learned no lesson about what proper conduct is, and I think he must be quite taken aback at all of this. And I agree with you. I don't think he wants to get impeached. I got a nice text from my daughter today, who's in college, so it was wonderful to hear from her. And she asked me what I thought of this theory. Does Trump want to be impeached because he can use it as a cudgel? And I don't think so at all. And maybe we'll get to this later. But did you have a chance to see any of his press conference?
I did.
Late this afternoon?
On the so-called whistleblower information, even though it was supposedly secondhand information, which is sort of interesting. And other things have come out about the whistleblower that are also maybe even more interesting. But also insist on transparency from Joe Biden and his son Hunter on the millions of dollars that have been quickly and easily taken out of Ukraine and China. Millions of dollars, millions and millions of dollars.
He looked terrible. Like a low energy, to pick a phrase. This is not making him happy. I think this whole thing has backfired on him, and they have brought it upon themselves.
I agree with that. You know, I don't know if he was doubling down or if he felt vindicated. Remember, the testimony of Robert Mueller was the day before he made this call to President Zelensky in the Ukraine. And so, you know, he feels very entitled here to basically say the United States spends a lot of effort and time on Ukraine, but it's not reciprocal, meaning you're not holding up your end of the bargain. Europe has to do more. Essentially, you know, you want things from us like military aid and other things, which he doesn't say explicitly, but it's very much in my mind implied. And then he goes on to say, I want to ask a favor. And that really, to me, it's so clear that that's the entire point of the conversation, is to basically say, look, you know, we do a lot for you. You don't do enough for us. And here's my ask. And then he goes on to talk about this conspiracy theory related to Hillary Clinton's emails, which he talks about CrowdStrike, which is the company that the Democratic National Committee had hired to do that initial investigation for the DNC into who had hacked the Clinton emails. And then he goes immediately into Biden. And Biden is specifically named. And, you know, I didn't expect to see it in black and white that clearly, that this call was completely about trying to get the Ukrainians to investigate his leading political rival.
Right, because what is the reason? If you're generally talking about corruption, there's all sorts of corruption in a lot of different places. You can say it generally. You know, it reminds me always of the pretext that Trump has used in the past and got Rod Rosenstein to write the memo on, saying, well, one basis for firing Jim Comey is that he wasn't nice to Hillary Clinton. Who believes that? Nobody. And here also he's saying it's just, you know, he's making a general point about corruption. But just to go back to the basic point again that I think people need to understand and remember, because you're going to hear the talking point from a lot of folks. We heard it from Lindsey Graham today and other Republicans, not all of them, but some of them, that there is no direct quid pro quo, so there's nothing to see here. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. If you've been in this line of work for any period of time, you and I both know that there is never a written or spoken, almost never, explicit quid pro quo. We convicted lots of significant politicians in New York on implied quid pro quo, but putting that aside again for a second, the fact that he's abusing his power by asking this kind of thing and mentioning a political rival by name, there's no excuse for it, combined with saying that he wants to accomplish this, not just by asking this other person who's running another country to do it, but saying, call my attorney general, work with him. So he's bringing the United States government to bear on it also, simultaneously talking about his other personal attorney besides Bill Barr, Rudy Giuliani. It seems like completely out of bounds with respect to how we expect a president to behave. And if you want to do the thought experiment, but it doesn't make a lot of headway in persuading people that this is bad if they don't want to believe it. Just imagine any other president in the past doing that with respect to the son of a future political rival. Obama doing it with respect to Mitt Romney's son in 2012. You just can't do that. So bottom line is, it is crazy bad on its face. He didn't get that. On the question of whether or not there's a direct quid pro quo, no, there's not. But let's spend a minute talking about, and you mentioned some of these features already, what evidence there is, both in the document from the conversation and also surrounding context, that suggests you could make a pretty good argument in a summation once you have more evidence and you have other witnesses, that it is quite clearly a quid pro quo, something for something, even though it's not stated specifically. Among them, among those things you say, there was clearly a mention of the Ukrainian president buying missiles, javelins. There is the context of this money that's been approved by Congress that hasn't come in yet. There's the hope for future opportunities. There's a doctrine in corruption law in many places that talks about you know, an arrangement in which people understand that as opportunities arise, you want to, you know, grease their hands a little bit to get those future opportunities. So it can be either, and people, I think, sometimes talk about it as bribery, the flip side of which is extortion, right? If you do this thing, I will give you something. And the flip side of that extortion is if you don't do this thing, I'm going to withhold something from you, or I'm going to punish you in some way. And there's a bunch of evidence to that extent, right? Donald Trump says specifically over and over again, we do a lot for you. We do a lot for Ukraine. And as you said, it's not reciprocal necessarily.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think your point about the two sides of the coin, that it could be we're not going to sell you missiles or we're not going to give you money, or this is a quid. There are a lot of different ways that the pressure was being put to bear here. And it's important to note that Zelensky at the time of this call knew that that money that they were waiting on and that they desperately need for the safety and security of their country, millions and millions of dollars, that money was being held. And the Ukrainians knew that. What's important to note also is that there's a level of consciousness of guilt here that we did not have in the 2016. There was just a different conversation about what the president knew, what he could understand, what the boundaries were. Here you have, in the wake of the 2016 election, Russian interference, all the conversations about the Mueller report. The president talks about it, tweets about it constantly. You have him calling a foreign leader and essentially pressuring him and putting the full weight of the United States government on him in a way that feels to me exactly like you say. It may not be explicit, but the reality is that, in my experience, people who commit crimes use only the amount of force or fraud or extortion. It's calibrated to use the amount that's necessary. You know, if you don't need to make an explicit, we're not going to do this unless you do this, you don't do it. We see constantly in crimes that people use only the amount of deception that's needed in order to accomplish their goal. There is no question here that the president was sending a very clear message, at least in my mind, about this. You know, and again, it's not about the crimes, but it's worth just refuting this complete line of argument, because this is the president's primary argument right now, is that there is no quid pro in the memo and therefore I didn't do anything wrong. It's worth noting that you don't need a quid pro quo, that there's campaign finance laws, which, again, from the Mueller investigation and from 2016, it's very clear that a political campaign cannot accept anything of value, including dirt on a political opponent, from a foreign government. There's constitutional provisions that prevent the president essentially from abusing his authority in office. There's a ton of different ways in which we can think about this criminally. And yet, it feels to me like it really is a smokescreen that's being put up by the president to say, I did nothing wrong, because there's nothing in this letter, in this memorandum. The other point, Preet, which I think is pretty clear, is that, you know, you have Senator Ben Sasse, who's a Republican member of the Intelligence Committee. You have him walking out of a period in time today after he's been in the secure room in the SCIF reading the whistleblower complaint, where he says, you know, the Republicans, of which he's one, should not be quick to circle the wagons on this matter. There's a lot here. And so it's not just the memo.
But I'll just say about Ben Sasse for a minute. I don't want to talk ill of senators, but, you know, I quite admired and respected him early on in his tenure, and he would say things that were not knee-jerk partisan. And he's a pretty smart guy, written a lot of books, and a thoughtful intellectual. And in recent months, he has not been that way. And there's been a lot of talk about how he seems to have been co-opted a little bit by Trump. So it's encouraging to see that he's prepared to say things that won't necessarily gel with the leadership or with the White House, unlike Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, you're right. But I think the bigger point is that this isn't the end of the conversation or the inquiry. It's the beginning. You know, this is one memorandum. It's clear that the whistleblower complaint contains things beyond this one conversation. And also remember that there's the opportunity to get all different types of corroboration from witnesses in the Office of Management and Budget who were withholding the funds, from people in the State Department who Giuliani allegedly, according to him, had conversations with. And so, you know, I really think it's a distraction and sort of a red herring in many ways to just have this quid pro quo conversation, because I think it's not needed, and also it's likely there.
No, and it's a total red herring. It's corrupt on its face. It's an abuse of power on its face. If you can also show a quid pro quo, that makes it even worse. Let's talk about the whistleblower for a second. So we don't know too much more about him or her. I think I mistakenly recently assumed it was a him because I thought I'd read that somewhere. Another document has been made available, an Office of Legal Counsel opinion that runs to 11 pages that I actually don't think is very good. It's the opinion that gives the guidance that the standard is not met for the disclosing of the whistleblower's complaint to Congress, because as we've talked about before, it doesn't relate to intelligence gathering activity, and it doesn't relate to a member of the intelligence community, which we think is silly in some ways, and which the IG for the intelligence community has said is bogus. But in that memo, and you can see the reasoning, and it's not very good, I don't think, at the end of the day, they make a reference to the whistleblower. Which I don't know it was necessary to do in this document, that there's some suggestion of bias on the part of the complainant. But that being said, there was credibility to the complaint. We've already seen a whiff of this, and I fear we're going to see character assassination like you've never seen before once the identity of this person becomes known. You're already seeing it with respect to the lawyers who are representing the whistleblower. I think Donald Trump and others have already pointed out to the fact one place today, Trump pointed out that one of the lawyers for the whistleblower once donated money to whom? Joe Biden. You know who else did that?
Donald Trump. Yes.
Right. And it's this failure to understand that you separate lawyers from their clients, and that doesn't show any kind of bias at all. In fact, one of the lawyers that Donald Trump hired with great fanfare not too long ago worked on the Clinton impeachment on Clinton's side. So you're going to see – I mean, what do you think is going to happen? I fear we're going to see – a crazy amount of attacks on this whistleblower, mostly unfair, because that's what we've seen before. And I don't know who it is, and maybe there are reasons to doubt credibility, because some witnesses have credibility problems. But you know, I fear it's going to be kind of a show.
I agree. I could not agree more. I think it's going to be an effort at character assassination. And again, you know, if they don't have the facts in their favor, they're going to just try to personally attack the person who has come forward. There are two points on this that are worth talking through a little. The first is that it's clear that any questions about political partisanship were known to the Inspector General, the Intelligence Community Inspector General, Michael Atkinson, nevertheless found that this was credible and that it was an urgent concern.
Yes,
it's really important to understand. And you and I, you know, as prosecutors and as lawyers, you are always evaluating witnesses' credibility. It's always a piece of it. And that is one thing that the Inspector General, who again was appointed by President Trump, he's already done that. The second piece, which is really critically important to think about here when we think about the way that this probably will roll out, is that it's been reported that the whistleblower provided a lot of different leads for corroboration. And this is something that we're also very familiar with in criminal trials, that, you know, you have one person who comes in and says something, and you and I would never walk in to try a case without trying to figure out who else saw it, who else has information. And it appears that the Inspector General conducted a full investigation to come to the credibility determination, or at least a thorough investigation to come to that determination. And so I expect that there'll be nothing but character assassination from the president. We've seen it even as to Robert Mueller's team about partisan bias, because to the extent the president can make it look political, again, he thinks that that will make it look as though he has not done something wrong. I strongly disagree with it, but I think you're right.
100%. Yeah, 100%. And the other thing in the OLC opinion you see, in fairness to the administration, is even though they said they made the determination that this particular complaint doesn't fall within the statute that requires its disclosure to the intelligence committees, that doesn't mean that if bad behavior is observed, as this whistleblower, you know, observed or became aware of this phone call and other things, there still has to be some basis for accountability. So in fairness, they say it doesn't mean that you're at the end of the road. And what they say is you know, then you go through normal channels to see if there's some malfeasance that can be investigated. And so that apparently was done on a fairly, you know, quick basis, seems like a rush basis, by the Department of Justice. That within the criminal division of the Department of Justice, they took a look at these things and determined that they would not bring any case. And I think, if I have this right, not even proceed with any investigation.
Yes.
Having made the determination that the thing that would have been alleged as far as a campaign finance violation, for example, the requested investigation of a political rival did not amount to a thing of value for Donald Trump's campaign. So what I think has been underreported and undercovered so far is that there seems to have been an entire mini little analysis of whether or not this stuff that the Democrats now insist, this stuff that the Democrats now say they're thinking about impeaching Donald Trump for, has been evaluated on a fairly quick basis by people in the Department of Justice, not a special counsel, not someone independent, by people in the Justice Department, and determined no crime could possibly have been committed here, and they declined. And I know you and I, based on our texting all day today, have a particularly strong feeling about the fact that Bill Barr, as the Attorney General, in charge of the department, when that decision was made not to pursue some further investigation, you might have a view on that.
Yes. I mean, it's outrageous if Barr did not recuse himself and this decision was made within the department, given that he is named, you know, by my count, no fewer than three times the president mentions him during the conversation with Zelensky and basically says, I want you to talk to the attorney general. The attorney general will call you. Barr is lumped with Giuliani as a part of the president's team of lawyers, and it looks incredibly partisan. Now, Bill Barr has come out and said, you know, through spokespeople, initially he came out and said, I wasn't aware of the request for me to call the Ukraine. And then his spokesperson came out and said, the president has never asked him to investigate Biden. And so Barr is now denying that he has knowledge of this, but even on its face, if Barr saw this memorandum, which it's clear that this memorandum came to the Department of Justice for review as part of the conversation about should there be a criminal investigation that's initiated, in that case, Barr should not have anything to do with it. We don't know whether he recused himself. It appears he did not from the public comments that his spokesperson is making, but that alone is deeply troubling. The other piece is, I think to your point, what's been publicly reported is that they did not conduct a full investigation. They merely interviewed the people who were privy to this conversation between the president. And so it may come out that they did more than that. But the initial reporting, this idea that on its face, they don't think that this kind of conduct would basically account for a violation of the campaign finance law, it feels exactly to me like Bill Barr's summary, non-summary of the Mueller report, which, as we know, was factually inaccurate, that, you know, he made certain conclusions about, you know, what the law was. Even in his memo, frankly, before he became the attorney general, the memo that he wrote to the Department of Justice and to the president, it just strikes me as incredibly conclusory. And if they didn't go beyond this very basic cut, you know, and if the instruction was don't do any interviews beyond just confirming what was said and whether anything else was said and cabining this to the four corners of the memo, that's not an investigation. And any conclusion that they would have made about whether or not this was prosecutable under the law, I would not accept.
You know, what's interesting about that is that unlike in other circumstances, Bill Barr did not remain silent, either on his own or through intermediaries or representatives, nor did he do what sometimes Rudy Giuliani does and Donald Trump does and say the equivalent of, you're damn right I ordered the code red. There's a sense here, just as there's a sense about all of this stuff, that people are starting to figure out there's some trouble, right?
Yes.
Bill Barr is a guy who sat in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and said repeatedly that he would not necessarily follow the advice of ethics officials within the department. And he's pretty bold about his own powers and what he's allowed to do and what he's allowed to talk to the president about. And here you can sense there's a little bit of a retreat on this. So, you know, that's one of many fruitful avenues of inquiry in connection with impeachment or otherwise just general oversight. What did Barr do? Who was involved at the Justice Department in making this decision? How fair and forthright was it? And, you know, maybe there should be testimony from all these people on this particular point. You know, separate from that, there's what was Secretary of State Pompeo's role in any of this? He doesn't seem to be thrilled about being dragged into this either. There's this business in the phone call about the Ukrainian ambassador and bad things said about that person.
It sounds like Trump is threatening of what's going to happen to her. It sounds like she still works at the State Department. She was removed from her post as the U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine. But he sort of intimates that, you know, bad things are coming her way.
What's good about this, I think, for purposes of transparency and exposure of bad conduct and bad for the administration, is that there's no special counsel anymore. No one's under any illusion that the president can be charged. And I don't think anyone has an appetite for a new special counsel. So now, for the first time on something new that's not been, you know, beaten to death in the papers and there's been a drip, drip, drip based on scoops from all the major newspapers over the course of months and maybe even a year or two, you have new revelations happening at lightning speed and lots of things for not just the Judiciary Committee but multiple committees, including the Intelligence Committee, to investigate, about which people are going to be having revelations in real time, whether you're talking about the memo, we're talking about the whistleblower, policies that were practiced, how the OLC opinion came together. There's going to be a lot of I don't want to use this word, but for want of a better word, there's going to be a lot of spectacle. I think it'll be substantive spectacle, but that's the kind of thing that causes people to focus on what the conduct was, and it's much harder to sweep under the rug. But I think you'll see hearing after hearing after hearing.
I agree with you. And this morning in my free time, I started to make the witness list and the list of things that should be subpoenaed.
Who's on your list?
It's pretty long. And by the way, you started to tick off some of the names. But, you know, I think there are a number of State Department employees who are going to have had communications with the White House, are going to have had communications with Giuliani, including not just Pompeo, but the individual who oversees the diplomatic corps, obviously the ambassador to the Ukraine. There's going to be just, you know, people also at the Office of Management and Budget, people on the Appropriations Committees, every single conversation that relates to this should be probed. Every person who works in government who touched this in any way should be subpoenaed to testify. And I want to say one thing about the OLC memo, because we've talked about OLC. We've talked about the fact that when you look at the opinions, they overwhelmingly favor the current president and administration, and which is no surprise. And that's true on the Democratic side and the Republican side. What is really telling about this, again, is this attempt for the president and the executive branch to control every aspect of government, to literally control the state without any interaction with Congress. And so their recommendation that, oh, if there's a problem and we don't find that this is an urgent concern or that this is appropriately under the DNI for the whistleblower statute, for example, it should come to the Department of Justice. Again, keeping all the power and all the decision making within the Department of Justice that can then decide, do they do a real investigation or do they just do a sort of a makeshift pretend, let's look at the four corners of a memo investigation. And that is deeply troubling and ultimately would put the president above the law if that's allowed to happen. And so I think there is a lot here that needs to be explored by Congress that has to put checks and balances and has to put accountability measures on the administration.
Do you agree that although this is all new and different from what Mueller looked at, that if we hadn't had the Mueller investigation, which some people think ended with a thud because there's no charges and there's not a lot of appetite for impeachment as of July 24th, the day before Donald Trump made this fateful call to the president of Ukraine, that if we hadn't had that and all this stuff became known now, it still wouldn't have the impact that it's having, that it's the combination of what went before, on top of which now you have this, that is causing people to pull their hair out. So, you know, you got to be kidding me.
Yes. I think one thing is that it very clearly shows the president's intent, and the backdrop of the last 3 years really very clearly shows that we know that Donald Trump wants to win an election. We know he wants dirt on his rivals. He's been through this and he doubles down and essentially is willing to go. You and I have prosecuted a lot of cases. My experience with most people who have been through this type of investigation is that they don't want to go through it again. They do, it doesn't happen with everyone, but as a rule, Trump is just brazen about this. And again, it's almost as though he views himself truly as above the law. The Department of Justice is his lawyer. It's not the lawyer for the American people. And so there's something about this that feels like, you said the other day, it's recidivism. There's something about it that feels like, you know, you've done it before. You weren't held accountable. And I happen to believe that the
Mueller report, particularly volume two, provided a lot of evidence that the president engaged in wrongdoing. You then look at what he's doing here, and it's like he really doesn't care about the rule of law, and he's willing to do what he needs to do to win the next election. And it is, I think that resonates with people.
Yeah, look, it's a little bit of like sort of human psychology combined with what I've seen of judicial psychology. Maybe you've seen judges like this. I can remember very clearly and pointedly, there would be occasions where I would see a judge give a defendant a break and say, you know what? You did these things, whether it was drugs or robbery or something else, and the judge found something compelling about the defendant or the story or the defendant's family and says, you know, I'm going to give you a break here, either lesser jail time or no jail time, probation. But if I see you back here, you're going to have hell to pay. And if you ever come back here, if I put you on probation, you know, they would say it dramatically, you're not going to go out the front door, you're going to go out the side door. And the side door is directly to the lockup. Then I've seen that happen, where someone got a break and everyone was fine with that. And then, you know, after having gotten a break and having gotten, you know, lucky in a sense, when that defendant comes back before that judge, there is a certain amount of anger and disappointment. And I'm not comparing Donald Trump to that because it's different in many, many ways. But there's a little bit of that psychology that's at play. You got to be kidding me. You know,
you're right.
You're lucky enough to skate, and literally the next day, I still can't get over.
Maybe I'm
harping on it too much. I cannot get over the fact that it was the next day.
It was the next day, and from the conversation we have here, we know that what Trump says, according to this memo, quote, as you saw yesterday, that whole nonsense, meaning the entire Russia investigation and the obstruction of justice investigation, ended with a very poor performance by a man named Robert Mueller, an incompetent performance. But they say a lot of it started with Ukraine. So he sort of comes back to the part of the Ukrainian conspiracy theory, but it's like he's basically saying Mueller did a terrible job. That's over.
Yeah.
As you said, it landed with a thud, and yeah, now I'm moving on to do it again.
He's so emboldened. Like that sentence is a very crucial sentence just to understand both the psychology of Donald Trump, the malignant recidivism of Donald Trump, and how you can view his intent totally. He thought, yeah, this guy was a loser and a joker and I can do what I want. I can get away with it. And there are people who are like that. You know about them in the criminal sphere, and there are people like that in the political and business sphere, which now Donald Trump has been a part of both.
And to your point, I think it's a very fair reading that most people would take what Donald Trump went through as a warning and as a cautionary tale and would not rush in to do it again. And I agree with you on the American public. I also happen to think that when Mueller did the investigation, it was after the 2016 election and Trump had won the election. And so I think one of the issues or one of the hurdles with sort of breaking through on the Mueller piece and that investigation was that it was something that had happened in the past. It was you weren't going to undo the 2016 election. It was impeachment is an extraordinary measure, which we're now headed toward. But now, in the face of the 2020 election, having it very clear that the president of the United States is willing to do whatever he can to manipulate, to get evidence, to even, you know, potentially drag up something that's false about his political rival, he's essentially, you know, put the American election and the ability of the American public to decide who becomes the next president. He puts all that in play. And I feel like it's forward-looking, not backward-looking. And I think that's also a real distinction here.
Yeah. And look, we don't know what other things he's done. We don't know what other foreign leaders he's talked to. We don't know what other domestic prosecutors he's talked to. We don't know what other kinds of conversations he's had with Bill Barr. And I think one of the reasons this is important, whether it results in impeachment or not, it's clearly like I'd like to hear every Republican saying this is nothing answer the question, you know, not is it a crime, not is it an impeachable offense, not is it a high crime or misdemeanor, but the simple question, was it right or wrong? And I'd like to see people say, yeah, it was totally right. I get how people have to be political. And sometimes you have to put your foot down because if you don't say it's wrong or impeachable or whatever you think based on your conscience and what your evaluation of the evidence is, what's he going to do next week? I mean, if he was going to call the president of Ukraine the day after Bob Mueller testified and nothing happens based on this, what's he going to do tomorrow? What's he going to do when he's trailing the polls further? What's he going to do if it ends up being Elizabeth Warren and not Joe Biden? Or Bernie Sanders. You know, he is always going to find ways to manipulate the system and to put a thumb on the scale, I believe. And one of the thumbs on the scale for someone who has enormous power and control of the Justice Department and some sway with foreign leaders who have their own Justice Departments and their own investigative channels is to throw up dirt on an opponent. You know, time and time again, we never gotten a clear answer from him. Actually, we got a clear answer in the negative about what he would do if he got dirt from a foreign government. He said, you know, I think I'd take that meeting. Like, why wouldn't you? He's told us all along what he thinks. And you say it exactly correctly. You know, it's one thing to hold someone accountable for something that happened in the past, but to stand idly by watching like the next election get stolen or interfered with or cheated on, you can't do it. And I think he miscalculated. I mean, look, the other basis for knowing that he didn't want to get impeached and he thought he could talk his way out of this is the reporting suggests that he had an hour-long conversation with Nancy Pelosi thinking they could have a deal of some sort.
Yes.
And I think he miscalculated. As we look forward, hearings will be interesting. I also just think what Rudy Giuliani continues to say on television with apparently the full backing of Donald Trump will continue to be intriguing car crash television. What do you think?
I agree. I agree completely. And I want to also just say, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot, and you and I have both prosecuted public corruption cases, and we've been through a number of investigations similar to sort of, or at least to conduct that feels very similar to what we're seeing here. The thing I can't stress enough is that the very simple question that I keep coming back to is that Rudy Giuliani, he is a private attorney for the president of the United States. And Donald
yes.
Trump has said, this is all about corruption. I'm so worried about corruption in Ukraine. And that's defeated not only by the fact that the United States Pentagon had already said that they believe that Ukraine was taking enormous steps toward fighting corruption when they approved the military aid going. But put that aside for a second. If this was truly about corruption in Ukraine, and if this was truly, to your point, being done on behalf of the United States government, you do not send your personal lawyer. There's no reason why Rudy Giuliani should be involved in any of this. And so at the end of the day, the president's own excuses are belied by the fact that he sent a private defense lawyer for himself to Ukraine to do his bidding. And if this was a concern for the American government, you don't send your own personal lawyer to that country and to have those conversations. And so it just, you know, we should all be saying there's no reason for Giuliani to be there. And the fact that he is there is evidence, in my view, of wrongdoing. And we should get his phone, which he waved around.
I agree. I think you should go get his phone.
Are you deputizing me?
We're going to be talking about this every time we get together. There's a lot to process. You know, there's testimony that's coming up from the DNI, the acting DNI. We'll see if that sheds any light on anything, and we'll be back soon.
Thanks, Preet.
This is the Cafe Insider podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Ann Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Aaron Dalton. And the Cafe team is Carla Pierini, Julia Doyle, Calvin Lord, David Kurlander, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community. I hope you found our discussion valuable. Ann and I will be all over this story as it continues to unfold. Our goal each week is to bring sense to the avalanche of news so we can all be better informed citizens. So if you'd like to hear more of our analysis on the podcast and get access to all exclusive content like Stay Tuned bonus clips and a newsletter where I share my thoughts every week, consider trying the Cafe Insider membership for free for 2 weeks. You can sign up for the two-week free trial at cafe.com/insider. That's cafe.com/insider.
Thanks, Preet. I'll talk to you soon. Have fun.
Guys, I gotta run too. We went long.
Thanks, Anne.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.